All right, good evening again, and welcome for our continuation of this pastoral series on Laudato Si. Welcome to everybody on the internet as well. Glad to have y'all. For tonight, let's begin. We're just going to go ahead and start with a prayer, and so I'd invite y'all to just go ahead and bow your heads for a moment as we pray. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Lord, we ask your Holy Spirit to come down upon us today, that as we are here in this place, as we are gathered together around these words of this encyclical, that you would give us both wisdom and power. Wisdom so that we might see that which we need to do, and also the power and the strength of your Spirit, that we might be ready to begin the task before us. So we lift all this up in the name of Christ, our Lord. Amen. Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, great. Okay, well, a little bit of housekeeping just as far as where we are right now. This is our third out of four in this lecture series. We're going to be covering some more of Laudato Si on the care of our common home by Pope Francis. We've had the opportunity now to go through a little bit. At the beginning, we talked about what was a social encyclical. We talked about the introduction and the spirituality of St. Francis that is part of this encyclical here. We've also talked last week about pollution. We talked about physical and spiritual pollution. That when we look at this question of the ecological conversion that is facing us in the words of this document, we're called to recognize that this is not something that is merely a kind of physical problem. And so we don't need merely physical or technological responses to be able to deal with the problem that we're facing. A lot of the ecological degradation is a result of, at least Pope Francis is saying, it's a result of a deeper spiritual problem that we find within our hearts and within our culture. So we're gonna. So that was a lot of what we kind of picked up last time. And today we are going to move on, and we're going to cover a lot of territory in this document. I've been going somewhat slow because I wanted to give us plenty of time to get into the themes, but now that we're into the themes, we're actually going to cover kind of a big area of the document. As you may have noted already, or may remember at least from last week, I tend to jump around a little bit. And I don't do the paragraphs that we're going to study all in order because I will look at them in different themes. And Pope Francis, he says, actually, in the beginning of his thing, he says that he has important themes and that he will circle back around to them, right, to when he needs to. So I'm taking things a little bit out of order, and perhaps the greatest liberty that I'm going to take at this time is that I'm skipping one whole section. Because I'm going to come back to it, and we're going to look at it next week. Okay, so there's a whole section on the reflection of how we find this entire theme of ecological conversion, on the care of our common home, God's work in creation, and our co-working with God in creation, how all of that is found from cover to cover in the Scriptures. So there's a whole section on that, and I'm skipping that tonight because I want to come back to it when we come to our fourth lecture next week, which means that we have plenty of time in this one to focus in on more of the horrible stuff that's happening in the world. So, yay, I know, right? The subtext of our, or the subtitle of our talk here today is that we're talking about ecological conversion and a Catholic response. So again, we're going to go into a little bit more deeply, shall we say, into the problems that have already been recognized among the that we've already talked a little bit about, the areas of both ecological degradation, but then also social and moral degradation that we've been seeing, that different kinds of pollution that we've been talking about. We're going to try and dig deeper and really try to get to the core of it. We're going to find really the center, the philosophical kind of uniting point for Pope Francis's entire kind of vision of where he sees things have gone wrong, the spiritual core to where we've gone wrong. And then finally, once we've dug deep into that, we're going to see how it affects these other areas. And then we'll begin to start to look at some of the things that we can do in response to that once we've correctly identified the problem, okay? So that's the plan for this time. And then once we get to next week, we'll be able to talk about scriptures, and we'll be able to talk about sort of more about like what we can do practically and how we could be able to try to implement this into our own personal lives. So I'm hoping that next week will be a lot more enjoyable, if you will. I think we all recognize the need to be challenged, and that's part of the reason why we're here. But we can be able to end out on a note of the blessings of God working throughout the whole scriptures and how we're continue to be part of that process of God's working in the world. Sound all right? Okay, great. And by the way, I'm so glad that y'all keep coming back every week. I this is my first time doing a pastor series, so I'm just excited to see y'all here and to be part of this. And I've been thinking about this for a while, this Laudato Si. It certainly affected me when I read it. I felt convicted in a number of different ways of how I needed to take this to heart. So it's been on my mind a lot that if it's something that touched me so much, I want to make sure that I can be able to help share that with the church and through my ministry as well. Okay, well, we're going to take a look at a couple different paragraphs. Again, we've got a handy little sheet. I hope everybody's got one so that you can follow along. This first part here, it's segments from paragraph 101 and 106. These tie together because in these two segments, Pope Francis identifies that there is a big problem, and then he is able to tell us what it is, to define it. Okay. So I'll just go ahead and read through this. I'll read this whole little area that I've pieced together from 101 and 106. It would hardly be helpful to describe symptoms without acknowledging the human origins of the ecological crisis. A certain way of understanding human life and activity has gone awry, to the serious detriment of the world around us. Should we not pause and consider this? At this stage, I propose that we focus on the dominant technocratic paradigm. Yes, this is where we're getting very philosophical and the wording gets very technical here. So, but he's going to define things here in just a moment. But yes, these are important words and we'll come to understand them better in just a moment. I propose that we focus on the dominant technocratic paradigm and the place of human beings and of human action in the world. This paradigm exalts the concept of a subject who, using logical and rational procedures, progressively approaches and gains control over an external object. The subject makes every effort to establish the scientific an experimental method, which is, in itself, already a technique of possession, mastery, and transformation. It is as if the subject were to find itself in the presence of something formless, completely open to manipulation. Men and women have constantly intervened in nature, but for a long time, this meant being in tune with and respecting the possibilities offered by the things themselves. It was a matter of receiving what nature itself allowed, as if from its own hand. Now, by contrast, we are the ones to lay our hands on things, attempting to extract everything possible from them, while frequently ignoring or forgetting the reality in front of us. Human beings and material objects no longer extend a friendly hand to one another. The relationship has become confrontational. Okay. Like I said, this is the kind of philosophical core of what Pope Francis thinks is gone awry, has gone wrong in our world that has led us to this place. That there's a deep spiritual and philosophical problem that we have accepted. And that's what's going on here. Now, because this is his broadest, shall we say, vision of like what's at the core of all of these problems, it's like by definition very broad, right? And using very abstract language. So let's dig into this a little deeper so that we can make sure that we understand what it is that he's talking about here, okay? Okay, he talks here, I'm gonna go back up here. You know, the dominant technocratic paradigm. What is this paradigm? A subject using logical and rational procedures progressively approaches and gains control over an external object. That's what he means by a technocratic paradigm. Okay, what does that gobbledygook mean, right? Well, here's what we have going on here. It says a subject. A subject here is used to indicate a person, someone who can, an agent in the world, who can be able to do things in the world, right? So the subject who is a person, shall we say, who using logical and rational procedures. What are we indicating by this? Well, it's more expansive than this, but we could say, for example, science, right? So an individual who's using logical and rational procedures to understand the world around them, okay. But what ends up happening here? It's used to progressively approach and gain control over an external subject. And what Pope Francis is seeing here, he's basically kind of describing, well, in kind of over, you know, deeply philosophical terms, you know, what we do all the time with, well, in a word, oversimplified word, shall we say, science, right? To understand the world around us, to take it apart, to figure out how it works, right? And then from there to gain control over the world around us, right? Now, in a moment, we'll see this is not always bad, right? That we can be able to have this this way of understanding the world around us. And indeed, having power in the world around us is a good thing, right? We'll see that in just a second. But what he's pointing out, the problem is that we've come to the point where we don't see our relationship with external things, the world around us, or even other people around us. We don't see it as the meeting of friends coming together who can be able to shake hands, right? That's the image that he says here, right? You know, it's not a matter of that we are coming forward in any sort of mutuality. But what's happening instead is that it is a simply one-sided, violent movement of control and dominance that's happening. That the approach that we have fallen into, where things have gone awry, is not that we have power, not that we have science, not that we have knowledge, but that we have allowed ourselves to fall into a paradigm, a way of thinking, if you will, a paradigm in which that gives us license to be able to merely dominate and control everything instead of approaching it with some sort of respect, right? This is, in a sense, I mean, we could come up with a million different ways that human beings have acted in this sort of one-sided, aggressive, stealing, dominant sort of way, right? You know, think about any time and circumstances where there's any circumstances in history where there's a dominant power, right? And what do they do to all the other, like, you know, there's a dominant empire. What do they do to all the other kingdoms that are around them, right? Very easy, very common in human history that the answer was, well, they would just go over and they would just gobble them up. They had more power. They had more strength. They didn't come with a hand in any sort of mutuality or equality or friendship or respect. It came in the form of dominance and control, right? Possession and consumption, right? They would take all of their stuff. They would steal it and consume it for themselves. This is sort of, we can look back on this and we can be able to kind of look back on it and say, yeah, that's definitely a part of human history. But it's also definitely part of human history that we should say, well, we shouldn't be really proud of that, right? He says, this has become our dominant paradigm, this technocratic paradigm that we have, is that everything and everyone becomes, we apply this mindset to like anything and everything. That's where the problem has come in. We have this power, but we use it only in this one-sided way for our benefit, for our convenience, even when that means that we harm the other that's out there when we take from it. And that the problem with that is not that we, and the deeper problem, as we'll see going into this, is that not only that we can do that, but we think, and not only that we do it sometimes, but we actually think that it's a good thing. We treat it as if it's a good thing to unrestrictedly just go in and apply our knowledge and our power to the world around us and to the systems around us to be able to exploit whatever we want out of it. Okay? I like this this last line. I think it gives a little bit of a visual for us to kind of help us imagine this scenario here. Human beings and material objects no longer extend a friendly hand to one another. The relationship has become confrontational. Right? This is at the core of why it is that we have so degraded the ecological world around us and the moral realities of culture around us because we bought into this kind of technocratic paradigm. Okay. Let's continue on. We're going to take a look at these next couple paragraphs that I've kind of put together because I think this gives us a this will help us understand this kind of basic thesis that is at the center of this document. This is excerpts from paragraphs 102 and 104. Humanity has entered a new era in which our technological prowess has brought us to a crossroads. We are the beneficiaries of two centuries of enormous waves of change. Steam engines, railways, the telegraph, electricity, automobiles, aeroplanes, chemical industries, modern medicine, information technology, and more recently, the digital revolution, robotics, biotechnologies, and nanotechnologies. It is right to rejoice in these advances and to be excited by the immense possibilities which they continue to open up before us. Again, we had mentioned just a moment ago that, Pope Francis here is not proposing for us sort of an anti-technology, an anti-science, an anti-modern take on things, right? There are some who you know, say, for whatever reason, for many different reasons, although certainly for ecological reasons, people have said, oh, we need to give up on all of our modern technology, right? There are people who have said, well, we need to go back to the way things were. We need to get rid of all the you know, electricity and the internet and all of these things. We need to go back to the way that things were. That's when how we're going to be able to kind of set things right in the world, which is, first of all, just a fantasy, right? You can't turn back the clock. But on the other hand, like, you know, there are great things that have come from the scientific revolution, right? I mean, you know, think about the things that have just been such an amazing part of life that we can be able to exist. Modern medicine, right? The amazing capacity that we have to be able to restore health to our bodies. Like, should we go back to, right? Should we go back to the age when we were at the mercy of all of these different things that would, you know, could cripple and destroy us? I mean, I think anybody who thinks that that's a good idea is looking at the world through very rose-tinted glasses and has forgotten the benefits that we have, right? You know, the capacity that we have for knowledge and learning, right, is just unprecedented. Unprecedented. Nowhere in the history of the world. I tell people this specifically from my perspective, of course, as a Catholic priest. I tell people, you know, it's an exciting time to be Catholic. Never in the history of the church has there ever been more ways to be able to learn about the treasures of the faith with more accuracy and more readily available than nowadays. Never before. The entire history of the church, people would have longed for the opportunities that we have and that we have at our fingertips and we often just don't even think about, right? To be able to have the chance to learn and to grow and to be developed. And you could multiply this in so many other areas of education, right? Fantastic, wonderful, you know? We could come up with a number of, you know, more high-minded sort of things as well, but you know, sometimes I just even remind myself how wonderful and amazing it is that I get a hot shower every morning, right? It's like, this is amazing. This is fantastic, right? The things that we can so easily be able to take for granted, but are marvels and miracles and have come together over millennia and generations of us as a human species coming together to figure out how to be able to gain power and knowledge. Power and knowledge are not bad, right? They're evidently good around us. But as Pope Francis has warned us, we'll read here in just a moment ago, it's not the power that's gone wrong. It's our way of using it. It's our philosophy behind it that has gone wrong. Okay. So it says, it's right to rejoice in these advances and to be excited by the immense possibilities with which they continue to open up before us. Yet it must also be recognized that nuclear energy, biotechnology, information technology, knowledge of our DNA, and many other abilities which we have acquired have given us tremendous power. Never has humanity had such power over itself. Yet nothing ensures that it will be used wisely. Particularly when we consider how it is currently being used. We need but think of the nuclear bombs dropped in the middle of the 20th century, or the array of technology which Nazism, communism, and other totalitarian regimes have employed to kill millions of people, to say nothing of the increasingly deadly arsenal of weapons available for modern warfare. Never has humanity had such power over itself, yet nothing ensures that it will be used wisely. A brief tour of the history of history will tell us that, in fact, our own modern and technology-driven era, which is supposed to be so enlightened, right, has produced the bloodiest wars in human history. The millions and millions in, you know, World War I, and then we turn around and had World War II, right? The way in which our ideologies that we have bought into have demanded such enormous sacrifice of blood and life and of human suffering. Think about the two big ideologies that really kind of dominated through the 20th century, right? Communism and capitalism, right? He mentions here, you know, the communism, right? We have this idea, right? That this is how we're going to be able to create the ideal society, is through socialism, communism, right? This is going to how we're going to create this ideal society. And so what's the idea? The idea here is, like, you have this paradigm that you're going to put into place, right? And it's done what? In a way that's friendly? No. In a way that is done in pure dominance, right? And anybody who's not on board with this mindset, you send them off to the gulag. That's what he's talking about here when he's saying, this is the core. This is where we've gone awry. We might have an ideology, right, that we would follow so far that we lose sight of the capacity of even basic human decency because we're willing to put into effect this technocratic idea. Oh, we have this idea of how to create the perfect society, and there's no sacrifice that's too big, right? Because we're willing to just do whatever. We don't come with respect. We come with just dominance, right? You know, you could just there's no. It's not an exact comparison, but there's also needs to be recognized that, you know, the other great dominant force in the midst of this, you know, the sort of free market and free world, you know, part of the 20th century, has blood on its hands as well, right? And when you take into account the way that the sort of consumeristic greed can be able to cause such enormous amount of destruction and human misery in its wake, and death, right? In our so-called, you know, our post-enlightenment world, our so-called kind of, like, you know, high-minded technological world, what ended up happening? The world tore itself apart and caused unprecedented levels of death, destruction, and human misery for the sake of our ideologies in the 20th century, right? Wow, okay, well, that doesn't sound so enlightened, right, when you say it that way. Yes, we've made technological advances, but there is no guarantee that we're going to use them well. And if here I could put in my own kind of, just my own personal reflections. I remember when I was younger, I would have been in my 20s, maybe early 20s or something like this, and I remember that I was watching a movie. It was on television, and I didn't even know what the name of the movie was. Actually, to this day, I don't know what it was. But it was a historical movie about the nuclear crisis in Cuba, the nuclear missile crisis in Cuba. Probably somebody knows what this one is, but there was a movie made of it, right? And I was just flipping through the channels. I wasn't intending to watch this thing, but all of a sudden it caught my attention, and I started watching what was going on there. And I was aware at some level, I mean, I didn't live through it, so I was aware at some level that, oh yeah, there was this nuclear crisis and everything else like that. But they dramatized it, and you got to see it from many different perspectives, and the and the president and the, you know, all these, you know, sorts of things. And they showed, I'm sure with a little bit of, you know, Hollywood exaggeration as they do, but they showed just how close we were. Just how close we were to mutually assured destruction through nuclear warfare. And at the time I was in seminary, so I remembered one particular scene, you know, of they showed a picture of a street. It was probably in Washington, D.C. or something like this, and there was a Catholic church, and there was just this handmade sign sitting outside of the door, and it just said, "Confessions. We're open," or something like that. Like come in, confessions open, priests are all available 24/7, or something like that, right? And you just saw people just like walking off the street and being like, "Well, maybe we're gonna end the world tomorrow. So I guess I better go to confession." For me personally, right, I'd been, again, kind of intellectually aware that such a thing had happened. But then after watching that movie that night, man, I cried myself to sleep, because it so affected me of how damn close we were, and how it would, any small little decision different might have ended it. And I don't cry easily, but that got to me. I remember reflecting sometime later, because it was something that had been kind of rolling around in my own heart, like how much it had affected me. And I remember thinking sometime later about, you know, one of the kind of critiques that I had heard and I had known for myself of kind of like, well, you know, this younger generation that's coming up, this millennial generation that's come up, and how, you know, they what do they used to call it? You know, the me generation, right? It was this idea of like, well, you know, these younger generation coming up, and they don't care about patriotism, they don't care about the country, they don't care about this, they're only in for themselves, they're always into like irony, and you know, they don't take things seriously and such like that. And you know, true enough, I suppose. But I remember reflecting on that and just thinking to myself, you know, yeah, I could resonate with a lot of that as kind of the mentality of the younger generation, sort of thinking to myself, yeah, we don't take things seriously because of how frightening it is to see what happens when people really get like attached to an ideology and are willing to take it all the way. It was a great fear, at least for me. And what this says here, you know, about never has humanity ever had such power over itself. And nothing ensures that it would be used wisely. Yeah, there's a certain temptation of being able to say, well, maybe I should just lose myself in entertainments and frivolous things, because it's frightening, the idea of how much power is there. Paragraph 113. There's also the fact that people no longer seem to believe in a happy future. They no longer have blind trust in a better tomorrow based on the present state of the world and our technical abilities. You know, sometimes you run across this same sentiment, you know, people don't believe that there's going to be a happy future, and they say it as if it's a bad thing, right? Well, people don't believe that there's going to be a good future. They don't have hope for what the future is going to bring and such like that. People don't just have this optimism about that we're going to go someplace good, that we can be able to, you know, do, you know, that we're just going to automatically go be great, right? You know, we're going to go out there and do these things. But here, Pope Francis is actually kind of, in a sense, praising this. He's saying, yeah, people don't have an automatic sense that we're going to have a better future, a happy future. They no longer have a blind trust that technology is always going to just move us forward and into a better place. Again, that was something that certainly has resonated with me. As we go through these paragraphs, I want to just point out how these paragraphs, for the next four or five paragraphs here that I've outlined, they're kind of relating out the sort of sad, tragic consequences of what happens when you take on this technocratic paradigm that he's warning about. One, we don't seem to have a happy future. We don't have a blind trust that we're going to have a better tomorrow. And maybe sometimes that goes not only from kind of the loss of naivety, which is a good thing, but also to a kind of despair of like, why bother? Which is not a good thing. Paragraph 110, again, continuing the sort of litany of things that would be consequences of this technocratic paradigm. Life gradually becomes a surrender to situations conditioned by technology, itself viewed as the principal key to the meaning of existence. In the concrete situations confronting us, there are a number of symptoms which point to what is wrong, such as environmental degradation, anxiety, loss of purpose, and of community living. And once more, we see that realities are more important than ideas. He's pointing out here, life gradually becomes a surrender to the situations conditioned by technology. We simply, again, that's that despair that I was talking about, right? You know, yeah, we're worried about, you know, the future and where things are and how our world is going and stuff like that. But nonetheless, we still get sucked into watching the mass media or watching the television every night because, you know, it's an escape, right? And it's provided for us through our technology. And it's what everybody else is doing, right? So there's this kind of almost inevitability to being part of this, the situations conditioned by technology. Another way that we talk, that to me, you know, the way we surrender to situations conditioned by technology, you know, we one of the things that has come out in more recent studies about social media, which has become the dominant way that people get news, right, is through social media. They don't read a newspaper, but you get it out of your Facebook feed or something like that, right? Is that they've come to the conclusion that, well, what makes things go viral or what makes things become popular and stuff like that? Well, the easiest way to be able to get something to go viral and become popular is if it makes people angry. Because if you're angry, you're going to spend more time reading the article or more time watching the television show, right? So angry people spend more time with the media. And if you spend more time with the media, they get more advertising dollars. So therefore, the technological kind of like imperative that's behind this is make people as angry as possible. Now, what do you think that does to a country, to a culture that feeds itself primarily off from a media that has defined itself around the position, make people as angry at each other as possible? Well, you don't have to imagine it, you just have to look around. That's precisely what has happened, right? We slowly, life gradually becomes a surrender to the situations conditioned by technology, right? People will make the decision, well, I want to try to be able to live a life that's going to be more kind of ecologically friendly and stuff like this. But then you find that it's just so hard, right? Everything around the way that we build our consumer society, is not built in that way. And so it's just so hard to be able to make even the smallest kind of changes towards being able to live a more holistically, ecologically conscious and careful life. Right? He says, once more we see that realities are more important than ideas. This is that last line on there, Evangelium Gaudi, or Evangelii Gaudium. Realities are more important than ideas. Gosh, this is a thing that he repeats because it's from Evangelii Gaudium, which is his own previous encyclical, and he will say this a lot. Actually, Pope Francis will say this a lot. Realities are more important than ideas, right? What does that mean? It means that when you look at another person, you don't look at them and put a label on them and say, well, this person is a liberal or this person is a conservative, right? And therefore, I'm allowed to hate them or that you know they're on the other team, right? That's making an idea more important than a reality. No, here's a human person in front of you, right? Don't just give them a label and make the label more important. Reality is more important than ideas. When we followed our 20th century ideologies and said it was more important to create the ideal utopian state than it was to respect the dignity of a human person, well, then we create the gulags, right? Reality is more important than ideas. Don't get sucked into just ideologies and then start seeing the world that way. That's being sucked into this technocratic paradigm here. Paragraphs 111 and 112. We're starting to turn the corner here on the tone of this. There needs to be a distinctive way of looking at things, a way of thinking, policies, an educational program, a lifestyle and a spirituality which together generate resistance to the assault of the technocratic paradigm. We have the freedom needed to limit and direct technology. We can put it at the service of another type of progress, one which is healthier, more human, more social, more integral. It's very easy to just go with the flow. It's very easy to just be swept along by the ideologies, by the technological kind of current, right? The technocratic current that he's describing here. Very easy for us. But he's saying, we can do something, right? We can do something, and should we? But it's going to take, like, do you see what he says on here? It's not just one thing that we need to do, right? We don't just need to go out there and save the whales. We don't need to just go out there and stop pollution. We don't need to just go out there and defend the, you know, care for the poor. We don't just need to just go out there and, no, it's a, look at all the things he says need to come together. Thinking, policies, education, lifestyle, and spirituality, right? Because this technocratic paradigm pressures us on every level of our existence, we need to be able to create resistance in every single area. Does that make sense? Yeah. Talking about this interrelatedness, since everything is interrelated, concern for the protection of nature is also incompatible with the justification of abortion. How can we genuinely teach the importance of concern for other vulnerable beings, however troublesome or inconvenient they may be, if we fail to protect a human embryo, even when its presence is uncomfortable and creates difficulties? Right? I remember there was some cute little kind of signs that I see, you know, sometimes you'd see these things like, you know, save the baby seals or something like that as a, you know, kind of an ecological slogan. And then I remember seeing somebody who had flipped it around and it was a little baby seal holding up a sign that says save the baby humans, right? An integral understanding of what we need to do for caring for the world around us. If we care for, you know, animals and plants and ecological systems and so forth, then, and we do so because they're precious and they're vulnerable, then how can we justify the idea that we don't have to care for human life when it is most vulnerable and when human life is so precious? Again, this is, I think, one of the reasons why Pope Francis tells us that we need to, he's urging for us to come together in communication, in dialogue around these ecological issues, right? Because if the green movement, right, is able to ally itself simply with an ideology that says, oh, well, here's how we're going to save the world. We're going to ally ourselves with the, you know, kind of abortion and eugenics and things like that to be able to try to create a better world, right? Well, then if that becomes the only voice, right, then anybody who says, well, I do think that we shouldn't destroy the world that we live in, right? Well, then I guess I must also believe in abortion too, right? Do you see that? And here we're saying, no. That's why our voice needs to be part of any sort of, shall we say, green movement or just change of policies or such like that, that it needs to have a spiritual component to it and a moral component to it that we can be able to bring. And if we don't bring it, who will? Paragraph 122. A misguided anthropocentrism. This is the part of the document where it gets so technical. Okay, anthropocentrism, it means a worldview or an ideology in which humanity is the center of the entire system, right? So anthropocentrism is like when we see ourselves as human beings as the center of like everything else, everything revolves around us, okay? A misguided anthropocentrism, so the sort of anthropocentrism that says human beings are the center, but this is done in a very misguided way, leads to a misguided lifestyle. In the apostolic exhortation Evangelii Gaudium, which is again Pope Francis's own document that he's referencing back to, I noted that the practical relativism typical of our age is even more dangerous than doctrinal relativism. When human beings place themselves at the center, right? I said that's what the anthropocentric means. They give absolute priority to immediate convenience, and all else becomes relative. Hence, we should not be surprised to find, in conjunction with the omnipresent technocratic paradigm, and the cult of unlimited human power. He sees this as sort of a cult here. It's sort of a worshiping of an idol of our human power, right? A false god. Our human power has become a false god here. And the cult of unlimited human power, the rise of a relativism which sees everything as irrelevant unless it serves one's own immediate interests. This is also part of this technocratic paradigm, that you come to a practical relativism, right? Whether or not you are philosophically a relativist, practically speaking, there's this relativism that comes into place where the only thing that matters is me and my convenience, and everything else is irrelevant. That's the fruit of this technocratic paradigm as well. Paragraph 195, the principle of maximization of profits, frequently isolated from other considerations, reflects a misunderstanding of the very concept of the economy. So here we're talking about how the economy works and how this is also distorted by this kind of technocratic paradigm. It reflects a misunderstanding of the very concept of economy. As long as the clearing, he's giving an example here, as long as the clearing of a forest increases production, no one calculates the losses entailed in the desertification of the land, turning the land into a desert because it can no longer sustain the forest ecosystem, right? The harm done to biodiversity, or the increased pollution. In a word, businesses profit by calculating and paying only a fraction of the costs involved. Right? So he's saying here that this sort of mere dominance approach, right? And mere convenience approach, you know. Well, I bought this land, right, to develop it, and now I'm just going to cut down all the trees and figure out how much lumber I can be able to get off from that so that I can be able to sell that, and that's the profit that I'm going to gain. And if my profit is more than what I paid for buying the land, then, ta-da, I've made a profit. And yet, where do you count in the cost of the destruction of the land, the destruction of the biodiversity, right? All of the other costs that are part of it. Somebody's going to pay those costs, but it's not the short-sighted vision of those who are just seeking profit for this quarter. It's going to be us and the generations to come, the whole world. Paragraph 145. Many intensive forms of environmental exploitation and degradation not only exhaust the resources which provide local communities with their livelihood, but they also undo the social structures which for a long time shaped cultural identity and their sense of the meaning of life and community. The disappearance of a culture can be just as serious or even more serious than the disappearance of a species of plant or animal. Right? What's he describing here? You know, you can picture the scenario where you would say, oh, no, you can't develop in this area because there's a rare type of animal or plant or something like that that we want to conserve. Good, right? But what is he also saying here? No. You can't, here's what he's saying we should be able to do, right? We should be able to say, no. You can't, you know, just bring in some sort of very destructive technology or something like that into this area because it's going to destroy the culture, the human culture in that area. And that we should treasure the gift of human culture in its many different varieties and not simply assume that we can be able to destroy it. Like that should be just as much a problem to us to destroy a human culture as it would be. He says it's even worse, can be even worse than losing a species of animals or plants or something like that. Okay, these last three paragraphs start to take the turn of being able to say what are some of the lines of ways that we could be able to do things, that we could be able to make some changes in the world. And a lot of these are, a couple of these, are going to be things that are kind of big vision things. A lot of the stuff that Pope Francis, and I didn't fit this into our little document, our little summary here, he talks about things that, you know, happen on international levels and national levels and stuff like that. And these are things that, you know, we should be aware of, but I didn't include a lot of those here because, a little bit, but not a lot of these things because, you know, we here are not, you know, presidents and senators and so on and so forth, right? We do need to be aware because we are the ones who elect presidents and senators and so forth, right? But I did want to focus us a little, so I gave us a little bit of that, but also a little bit of a focus on to some of the maybe down to our level things that we should be able to do maybe tomorrow, right? Right? Something we could be able to start to do. Okay. This one here is probably the most immediate, and I really just kind of liked this idea. He says, in our rooms, our homes, our workplaces, and our neighborhoods, we use our environment as a way of expressing our identity. We make every effort to adapt our environment, but when it is disorderly, chaotic, or saturated with noise and ugliness, such overstimulation makes it difficult to find ourselves integrated and happy. And there's this kind of idea of like, you know, can we, not all of us are going to be able to go out and go save the rainforest, right? But what about your own neighborhood, right? What about the pollution that's there? What about your own yard? Even what about your own home, right? There's a popular speaker and nowadays, Dr. Jordan Peterson, and he's become one of his kind of catchphrases that he uses. He motivates people to try and pull their lives back together and kind of live as better people. And one of the things that he says in his things, one of his catchphrases, is that he says, "Do you want to know how to make your life better? Clean your room." He's very, surprisingly, actually, he's become immensely popular with young men from ages like 15 to 30 and stuff like that. Incredibly popular, millions and millions of views online and stuff like that. And he's very serious about this. He says, no, clean your room. Because if you can figure out how to be able to care for and clean your room, which is this little space that you have control over, he says, you learn, basically, you learn the skills of how to be able to do it on a bigger scale. And maybe if you can do your room, you could do your house. And maybe if you can set your house in order, maybe you could start to set your relationships and your family in order. And maybe you could do that. Maybe then you could be able to start to do something in, you know, a wider community. And then maybe if you can do that, right, like, do you see the, you know, but he says, you know, people get out there and they want to go change the world, right? And then you go look and you find out that they can't even keep their, you know, they can't even clean their room, right? He says, no, clean your room and then be able to work your way up to change the world, right? I think there's a great humility and practicality in that. And I think that, you know, that's kind of a nice, you know, starting point where it's like, it's very depressing, where it's like, oh gosh, what can I possibly be able to do, right? It's huge global problems. We're careening towards, you know, just an apocalyptic situation, and how are we going to be able to do it? Okay. Clean your room. Then, like, we want to fix the environment. Okay, fix your environment. Wherever it is that you have any ability to fix it. In your own home, in your own neighborhood, in your own communities. In whatever place where you are, can you be able to make it a more humane place? Less chaotic, less ugly, less polluted. And, you know, this last sort of thing is here, you know, that this, when we're saturated by noise and ugliness, such overstimulation makes it difficult to find ourselves integrated and happy, right? Again, there's this, kind of mixing these ideas together, but it's like, clean your room, right? The idea is that, like, get your own self in order, right? How can you be able to tell to your brother, well, let me take the plank out of your eye if you still have a plank in, you know, in your own eye, right? Remove the plank from your own eye, then you can be able to remove it, actually, the splinter from your brother's eye, right? What can we be able to do? Well, you know, if we want to save the environment, save your environment. Seek and search and work for creating a renewal of the environment in the place where you are right now. And then maybe you can be able to expand where you are to have more impact, right? But start there. I like that idea. Paragraph 173, enforceable international agreements are urgently needed since local authorities are not always capable of effective intervention. Relationship between states must be respectful of each other's sovereignty, but must also lay down mutually agreed means of averting regional disasters, which would eventually affect everyone, right? So think here now for a moment of like, you know, the the Amazon Synod that's going on right now, because the Amazon Basin goes through like 7 different countries, right? You know, it doesn't matter whether or not if one country is doing everything all right, but then the next one is polluting the whole place. It's like, well, I'm downriver from you, so therefore, you know, it affects me, right? So he says that. Now, I know this is where it gets tricky, right? Because how do you have enforceable international agreements? That sounds like, you know, a recipe for some sort of totalitarian super state that's going to come in and, you know, enforce all of these ecological regulations, right? But he says, no, he says it should be done respecting each other's sovereignty, but being able to work together, right? How do you do that? Certainly it's not easy, but that's, I think he's right. I think he's right. That's what needs to happen. By the way, there's a little note, or 180. Yeah, that's actually supposed to be a paragraph break there that I didn't put into this correctly. But anyway, so this paragraph 180 here as well. He says, there are no uniform recipes because each country or region has its own problems and limitations. It's also true that political realism may call for transitional measures and technologies, so long as these are accompanied by the gradual framing and acceptance of binding commitments. At the same time, on the national and local levels, much still needs to be done. Truly, much can be done. He names off a couple things, and he's trying to, like, we can do something. Like, let's do something, right? So again, this is speaking a little bit to the fact that, you know, we all don't have the power to be able to change national and international agreements, you know, today and tomorrow, right? But that this is the path forward, right? And I think it's a very clear vision of what it would take to make these sorts of changes, right? Recognizing that it's not all going to be the same everywhere, recognizing that it can't override the sovereignty of particular nations and states, right? Recognizing that there might be temporary technologies that you have to deal with, right? You know, there are people, well, we need to ban all fossil fuels and stuff like that. And it's like, well, there are these third world countries that are just getting their feet underneath them, and you're going to now tell them that they can't have fossil fuels, right? You know, even though we're the ones who cause most of the pollution, oh, now you don't get it, right? No, there might be transitional technologies that have to be put into place, right? It's not just going to be an all or nothing kind of answer. It's going to be messy in the meanwhile. But I think it's a clear vision of what would need to happen kind of politically and at a national and international level. And then finally, one last thing here. The majority of people living on our planet profess to be believers. And you may remember that when he addressed this Laudato Si, he said, to Catholics, yes, but to anybody in the world who would have good faith to be able to read this, right? So he says here, he's speaking to anyone, you know, so he's saying here, the majority of people on the planet Earth profess to be believers. They're religious in some way or another, whether that's Islam or Christianity or Judaism or different sorts of religions, right? He says, this should spur religions to dialogue amongst themselves for the sake of protecting nature, defending the poor, and building networks of respect and fraternity. And I've mentioned this before, but you know, I think it's worthwhile mentioning again. You know, like, there are we have important things that we need to bring to this conversation as religious people and as Catholics. And if we don't, then it's not going to become part of the conversation. And whatever methods, whatever changes are implemented are going to be changed without this moral and spiritual vision that we can be able to bring. And that we have the opportunity to, not only among ourselves, but with, you know, other people of faith, to be able to also have that same kind of pressure, and that we can be able to bring, to be able to help bring a better and a more holistic vision of what it would mean to have this ecological conversion and transformation. Okay. Well, then we're going to finish up for tonight. I'm looking forward to one more. And in that one, I promise you guys, we're not going to be quite so depressing. We'll have a chance to be able to do a little bit more and finish this off well. So thank you all. Have a good night. God bless.